It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A new report from a UW-Madison Policy Institute, it examines how working people in Wisconsin are doing by analyzing jobs and wages and unions. We explore findings in the report called State of Working Wisconsin. You can be part of the discussion about conditions in the labor market. Call in with a question, add your perspective, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Laura Dresser is Associate Director of COWS. That's a UW-Madison think tank promoting solutions to social problems. Laura, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me. I'm glad to be here.
So your new report on work in our state shows mixed signals for workers. We're going to dig into those details. But first, is this a good time to be a worker in Wisconsin?
I mean, so I've written versions of this report since 1995, which says something about this working Wisconsinite. And I think, you know, in terms of the short-term signals on jobs, the tightness in the labor market really allows workers some bargaining leverage that they haven't had in a long time. And I think that's one thing that's clear right now. It's not, you know, it's not a paradise, but that the sustained low unemployment is really helping workers make their jobs better. So, yeah, it's better than most times.
For more than two decades, the Working Wisconsin reports have really presented a worker's perspective on the economy. Does that perspective not get enough attention in the media or from lawmakers?
Yeah, I would say so. And it's really been the agenda of this report, in a way, is to try and put the median worker, the worker's experience in the economy. I think so often when we talk about the economy, we turn to business voices, we turn to corporate profit reports, we turn to indicators of what's happening on that side. But in a fundamental way, the question is, what's going on for workers? How are their jobs changing? How is their experience changing? And we released this report for Labor Day to try and draw attention to that, those voices and that experience every year.
How do you find people to talk to and have them open up about their jobs, what their jobs are really like?
I mean, it's so mostly I'm using, representative survey data. So the federal government does the job of getting workers to talk about what their work's like. I look carefully, though, at the indicators of a kind of worker side experience. So what's going on with wages, what's going on with jobs. Most years we do actually get in touch with a handful of workers. And this year there'll be a panel of workers sort of responding to these work results on Wednesday. They've been active in union organizing campaigns in the past year, but the data is really trying to create a worker's perspective from representative survey sample data more than actual worker voices.
We're talking about the state of working in Wisconsin. Laura Dresser with us, Associate Director of COWS at UW-Madison. You can join in about the labor market, your questions, your perspective, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Laura, the number of jobs in Wisconsin topped 3 million, a record high in July. How significant is that number?
I think that number is important, especially over the last year. The Federal Reserve has been really focused on kind of cooling off the economy and bringing inflation down, right? That's been the priority at the federal policy setting level. And that had me concerned, because when you talk about raising interest rates and cooling off the economy, you tend to be talking about job loss equally and increasing unemployment. And what we've seen over the past year at the federal level and in the state is that we've had steady progress in jobs, that jobs have finally in the state recovered above the level that it held in 2019. that in this latest national jobs report, workers are still coming into the labor market. People are still finding, getting attracted into jobs, and the job base is growing. And that is and sort of good news, but something that, you know, Wisconsin to finally get to that peak and to end in this last year, get over the 2019 level, really, really mattered. Is an indicator of the health of the economy and opportunities for workers.
And meanwhile, the unemployment rate dropped as low as 2.4% this year, another record there. Why is employment so strong? What does this growth do to?
I think there's a pretty good indication that, you know, I think coming out of the pandemic shutdowns, I think it was hard to see like what is really going on here for a few years. Like, is this just recovery? Is this the federal investments, et cetera? I mean, clearly the federal investments are helping keep the economy strong. That would be the Infrastructure Act, the Inflation Reduction Act, CHIPS. These are mattering to jobs and creating jobs. But also workers are working and getting raises, consumer demand remains strong. So there's just a kind of a lot of mutual strength in the economy.
What industries are seeing the most job growth?
The most job growth in Wisconsin has been, I'm sorry, if
that's okay, take your time.
Yeah. Wisconsin's jobs are, we tend to be kind of strong in manufacturing. That's been a little bit of growth, and construction also in the state, pretty strong job growth. So we've seen some strength in those sectors for sure.
Meanwhile, information and hospitality show pretty big drops. What's going on there?
You know, the information drop is the hardest one to explain in some ways. Wisconsin's information sector is down by more than 8%. And nationally, it's up by almost 6%. So that difference is the biggest, you know, deviation of the state to a national trend that we can see. I don't know the underlying, you know, what the restructuring there is, but I do know that with that trend and falling behind in business services pretty substantially as well, some of the more professional or higher wage and higher education demand sectors are really lagging with the national trends. And that's a little disappointing to see.
Turning to women in the workforce, for decades, women held a really strong presence in Wisconsin's workforce. And you say that trend is starting to decline. What are you observing?
So, you know, I've always, if you compare Wisconsin women's labor force participation to the national women's labor force participation rate, for many, many years, the Wisconsin rate was 10% or more higher, just really much higher levels of work in Wisconsin than at the national level. And that kind of hits a high in the late 90s, and both the women's labor force participation rate and the national, both Wisconsin and the national sort of coming down. But Wisconsin has really dropped dramatically from almost 75% of women working down to 65% now. Mm-hmm. And that drop's been especially intense since the pandemic. So the gap, Wisconsin women still more likely to work than the national level, but the gap is much smaller. And a lot of that closing has happened in the last few years. And I think the challenges in childcare, something women have faced all over this nation, women tend to take the lion's share of childcare or child responsibilities in managing relationships with childcare providers in the houses, in our homes. And we've just seen that that sector be under incredible stress. I think especially in Wisconsin in the last few years, we're seeing some impact perhaps of that on women's labor force participation.
Laura Dresser is Associate Director of COWS. It's a UW-Madison Policy Institute that's published a new report assessing our state's labor market conditions for workers. Call in with a question. Share a comment. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A new report from a UW-Madison think tank seeks to provide a clearer picture of what is happening in our state's labor market and how workers are faring. The report is called State of Working Wisconsin, and labor economist Laura Dresser is lead author. You can take part in this discussion, calling in with your questions, share concerns, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Laura, when you look at inflation, you found wages continue to grow in 2022 as they have for the past few years, but inflation spiked last year, really wiping out those pay gains for some people. How did inflation and wage growth interact?
Well, I think probably most of the listeners actually experienced this in real time. Prices were going up and wages for some workers were stuck. Some workers managed to negotiate better wages or change jobs for better wages. But even for workers whose wages went forward, they didn't go up as high as the inflation was in 2022. This is data ending in 2022. And so while wages went up substantially from 2021, you know, the inflation rate was stronger. And so workers were left behind in terms of purchasing power at the median, the worker in the exact little middle of the labor market. Their wage in 2022 was ironically $22.02, which is almost like the year, but not quite. and that fell back to the purchasing power the median worker had in 2019 was. So that's sort of 3 years of lost wage growth. We've had really steady wage growth since about 2012. So we're still above that, but the 22 inflation really took it out of wages this year.
There was one group that was able to stay ahead, though, of inflation. Low-wage earners saw pay increases that beat inflation. Why have low-wage earners done better than other groups?
I mean, this is, I think, the best news of the post-COVID shutdown economy. So we had the collapse in 2019, the shutdowns for COVID. And I think a lot of especially workers in service jobs at the bottom of the labor market were getting told they were essential and were facing, high risk in retail and restaurants, things. The economy got very tight and those low wage workers have been really faced with this sort of unsustainable job model for many of them. Wages are low, hours are volatile, benefits are almost non-existent. All those workers who have direct contact with customers, almost very few of them have paid sick leave even. And I think in the growth and the tight labor markets that came out of during the recovery from that, workers really began to look for better. They began to ask for better in the jobs they had. They began to move to better jobs. I think there was a sense that there was a great resignation, but it was really a great upgrading. Workers found better jobs. Workers made their jobs better. And this happened especially in the low-wage labor market, which closed some of the gaps that the U.S. economy has had for so long between the lowest wage workers and median workers. That's just been growing for most of the years I've written this report. And over the last 5 years, we've seen some closing in that gap. That doesn't mean it's gone, but it's the lower wage workers who have done better in the recent years relative to inflation and doing better in this economy. And it's good to see that equality, kind of this a little bit of tightening coming.
A little bit of adjustment there. We've also here been tracking the workforce housing problems, higher rents have really hit low-wage workers particularly hard, and that's according to the U.S. Census Bureau. How have housing costs affected Wisconsin workers?
Well, the housing costs, you know, one of the most central way that this is going on in this data especially is that inflation rate, the high inflation of 2022, a lot of what was contributing to the increase in inflation was very high housing cost inflation. This was especially true for renters. And lower wage workers tend to be renters. And so they were facing incredibly high increases in housing costs. And so, you know, demanding the wage increases is part of it. I don't think that these wage increases create real long-term sustainability. The housing costs as a share of a low-wage worker's income are still unsustainable at you know, well above the 30% that the federal government recommends. And low-wage workers are, especially when they're renting, likely to be facing very severe housing stress in their budgets. But at least the wages, you know, kind of generally kept up with the overall inflation rate, it isn't to say that those workers aren't facing incredible stress, especially with housing costs.
We're talking about the state of working here in Wisconsin. Laura Dresser out with the new report, Associate Director of COWS at UW-Madison. You can join in with your questions at 800-642-1234. Laura, your report looks at unions, shows that when labor union membership declines, the richest 10% of the population benefits with income growth. How are these two trends interacting?
Yeah, I think this actually has gotten some federal, the Council of Economic Advisors just released a report on how unions are good for equality and for society. I think it's something we kind of forget. We think of unions mostly operating inside a firm. That's the first place they operate, right? For the workers themselves that are represented by the union. It's you know, kind of research shows that unions that are represented by represented by unions get paid more than workers that are not in specific sorts of jobs. But at a second level, having union representation or the threat of unionization, especially as the density of union increases, begins to spill out into the economy so that other employers raise wages to avoid unionization. And this kind of begins to spill out what a union does into the general economy, not just for a worker, but for workers in general. And finally, unions really operate at a social and political level to represent worker interest. And to be in the political dialogue that, kind of balances or is negotiating business and worker interest. Unions are the voice of that worker interest, and they're the strongest and most organized voice. And so politically they matter for, whether it's healthcare or wage regulation. Unions make a big difference in those places. And if you have a strong labor movement, then you have stronger social protections for all workers. And that's, I think, what this chart is really pointing out, that in our most unequal times in the U.S., we've had low representation of unions because we continually lack really well-organized workers' voices and demands at the political level. And when you have stronger labor movement, you get that back.
In our last 30 seconds together, based on this report, what recommendation, top line recommendation, would you make to policymakers that would improve Wisconsin workers' lives?
I have three quick ideas. You know, one would be invest in childcare, the childcare industry, to support working women, getting support women in work, and raise the minimum wage. And consider paid family leave again to support women's work.
Laura, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Great to be here.
Laura Dresser is Associate Director of COWS. That's a UW-Madison think tank. You can find a link to the State of Working Wisconsin report. It's at WPR.org/mornings. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Great Lakes coastal wetlands are vital to Wisconsin. And according to the Environmental Protection Agency, we're losing them. But for over a decade now, a monitoring program is helping scientists limit further degradation and address water pollution. As we discuss wetlands, call in with a question, share a comment, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Madeline McGee is Great Lakes and Mississippi River Monitoring Program Coordinator for the Office of Great Waters at the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. Madeline, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Good morning. Erin Giese here as well, Principal Investigator for Great Lakes Coastal Wetland Monitoring Program, overseeing a research team studying birds and frogs in wetlands between Chicago and Michigan's Upper Peninsula, also Senior Researcher at the Cofferin Center for Biodiversity at UW-Green Bay. Erin, welcome.
Hey, good morning. Thanks for having me.
Good morning. Erin, let's start with you. The monitoring program, 13 years now in the making. You've been involved since the inception. How do you view your role in this geographically vast collaborative research project?
Sure. It's been one of the most fun projects I've been privileged to work on in my career. And my role as one of the lead investigators is to coordinate and organize field crews to conduct field surveys of breeding birds and anurans. Anurans is just the fancy word for frogs and toads in the Great Lakes coastal wetlands. And so I send student researchers essentially from Chicago to the Eastern UP, like you said, and they conduct breeding bird surveys around April through mid-July every single year.
So a lot happens in the summer months. And this is, you know, the Great Lakes Basin, the shoreline, it's really massive, you know, considering there are over like 10,000 miles of Great Lakes shoreline. How do you know where to go and what to prioritize in the data collection?
Oh, sure. That's a job for other investigators. Mm-hmm. That's not my role to choose them. Mm-hmm. But we have other investigators that set up a stratified sampling design where we sample a portion of all possible Great Lakes coastal wetlands once every 5 years. So there are over 1,000, and we sample about a fifth of those every 5 years. And so we have this excellent online centralized database that allows us to point us to the places that we're supposed to survey every mm-hmm. single year. And then we have our crews go out and scout and establish monitoring points in those wetlands.
Madeline, how does the monitoring program improve the DNR's efforts to protect wetland habitat in Wisconsin?
Yeah, great question. So the really great thing about the Coastal Wetland Monitoring Program is that we have very consistent, reliable data, which then DNR uses to kind of gain information about all of the wetlands and, you know, the coastal wetlands in our state. And we kind of use it the same way like a doctor would when you go to the doctor and get lab tests done. We take all that information, we figure out, you know, the condition of our wetlands, and then we use that information to develop management plans for the wetlands. So some wetlands may be in high quality condition, and we may just take actions to protect them to maintain those conditions. other wetlands may be lower quality, and there are management actions we can take to try to improve quality of those wetlands and restore them to high quality conditions. So that's kind of how we use the Coastal Wetland Monitoring Program data in a nutshell.
Would the coastal communities also use the monitoring program's, you know, scientific analysis to make decisions about where to grant construction permits, for instance?
Yeah, so they definitely could. A lot of that would be on a more local level based on kind of their standards and criteria at the county or the city level. Mm-hmm. But I know some definitely do, and especially they'll use community information and plant and animal information to determine whether permits can even be granted or whether there's possibly protected species in the area that they may not want to, you know, put in any kind of infrastructure in that wetland area.
Aaron, there are more than 75 scientists working on the Great Lakes Basin projects at all times. How crucial is it to have every researcher involved using the same survey techniques?
Oh, great question. Extremely critical. We all use the same standardized monitoring survey protocols across the entire Great Lakes Basin. So we have colleagues in Canada, New York, Minnesota, Michigan, Wisconsin, all collecting data in exactly the same way. And if that were not the case, you wouldn't be able to conduct certain statistical analyses if you were collecting data differently, for example. So it makes it really useful from a scientific perspective, as well as applications like Madeline mentioned.
We're talking about Great Lakes Area Wetlands Research with Aaron Giese with the Great Lakes Coastal Wetland Monitoring Program. Madeline McGee here as well in the Office of Great Waters at the State DNR. You can join in with your questions and your concerns about wetlands. 800-642-1234. Let's bring in Jeff in Delafield. Hi, Jeff.
Yes, good morning. Really good topic. I just wanted to mention, I'm concerned about a study that I read about last week, a study out of some country in Europe that looked at wetlands and their impact on climate change or perceived impact on climate change. And the conclusion of the study was that wetlands actually contribute to methane. And the recommendation was that perhaps we don't restore as many wetlands or allow them. I mean, I guess the extension is allow them to exist. So I'm concerned if, you know, if there's more research like that, that it could really cause demise of some of our wetlands mm-hmm. or creation of new wetlands. So has your guest seen any similar studies that have come to similar conclusions? Thank you.
Yes, Jeff, thank you for bringing that. Madeline, you're using data from the wetlands monitoring to study climate change. What are you finding?
So we are using the Coastal Wetland Monitoring Program data to look at the status of some Lake Superior coastal wetlands and use that information to develop essentially sensitivity metrics so that we can protect wetlands from essentially either degrading or from being lost entirely due to climate changes. In terms of the specific study that our caller just mentioned, some wetlands that do emit methane, so do some lakes, so do some rivers. I think that is an area that we probably need more study on. But wetlands have pretty broad-scale benefits in terms of both habitat for species, but also for water quality benefits. They filter nutrients from the watershed before it enters, you know, our lakes, our rivers, especially the Great Lakes. So I would say even if some wetlands may be methane emitters, that the overall benefit is greater than that mm-hmm. kind of negative methane impact.
Aaron, do you have some follow-up there that you want to add on climate change and the Great Lakes Coastal Wetland Monitoring Program?
I thought Madeline did an excellent job answering it. I really do think wetland, the pros of wetlands are far greater than any cons that I can think of. I think the key is that they filter nutrients, they have biodiversity, and then of course they also have a lot of recreational benefits and economic benefits for folks, right? People enjoy kayaking and boating, fishing, hunting, bird watching, all those sorts of things. So I would just argue that I think the benefits far outweigh any cons of wetlands.
Jeff, thanks for the call. Now to Marcus in Milwaukee with a question. Hi, Marcus, go ahead.
Good morning, Kate. So I had heard that there's a program where they did a study through UW-Milwaukee Extension down near the Summerfest grounds where they reintroduced a set number of beavers. I don't remember if it was 20, 40, whatever. And they found that within a very short amount of time, the population had, I want to say, more than quadrupled. I was wondering if your guests had any information about any other programs where they're looking at other possible key keystone species and around the Great Lakes or elsewhere that that haven't been done yet.
Marcus, thank you. Aaron Giese, can I toss that one to you? I know birds and frogs, not beavers, but go ahead.
Yeah, our program does not look at beavers or any mammals. So I unfortunately cannot comment. I'm not familiar with anyone monitoring beavers in the Great Lakes.
So turning to you, Madeline, because of significant pollution, four waterways in Wisconsin are designated as areas of concern. How is data from the program supporting cleanup efforts in the lower Green Bay and in the Fox River area?
Yeah, so Erin actually knows a lot about this as well because we've been working with her and her colleagues in Green Bay on this. But we use Coastal Wetland Monitoring Program data and other data that Erin collects in the Green Bay area of concern to first figure out where we should be doing work in terms of habitat restoration, wetland restoration, but also additional habitats as well. So we look at the data to say which wetlands may be in a more degraded status and which ones we think have essentially ripe conditions for us to go in and make a really big impact with our limited funding. So we're using Erin's data and the Coastal Wetland Monitoring Program data to help figure out where to work. Once restoration projects are complete, we will be continuing to use their data and working with Erin to collect additional data to essentially assess how impactful and how effective those habitat restoration projects were so that we can use that information to inform whether we can remove what we call beneficial use impairments in the AOC. We use that data to show, hey, things actually have improved based on the actions we've taken, and now things are kind of up to par with the rest of the Great Lakes.
Erin, it sounds like this helps the data really helps prioritize what to focus on and where to go.
Correct. Yes, that is one of the overarching goals of the program, actually, prioritizing where money and resources should be spent throughout the Great Lakes. And then at this local level, I'll add, in addition to what Madeline summarized, is we're also using indicator metrics that have been developed through the Great Lakes Coastal Wetland Monitoring Program. So an indicator simply is something that can tell you about the health of an ecosystem. And generally, it's looking at species that are sensitive to human disturbance, pollution, and other factors like that. And we've been working closely with the DNR and others locally to develop a strategy for measuring priority habitats and populations of fish and wildlife in Lower Green Bay, including using indicator metrics developed by our Coastal Wetland Monitoring Program. So it's really neat. It's nice to see the, you know, our program data being used in a real world application.
Yes, very practical. Aaron Giese with the Great Lakes Coastal Wetland Monitoring Program, Madeline McGee with us, the Great Lakes and Mississippi River Monitoring Program Coordinator in the DNR's Office of Great Waters. You can be part of this environmental conversation. Call in with a question. Share comments at 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We learn how dozens of scientists work together to limit the further loss of wetlands in the most sensitive areas of the Great Lakes Basin. According to the EPA, over 400,000 acres of coastal wetland habitat are tracked through the Great Lakes Coastal Wetland Monitoring Program. You can call in with a question or comments, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Madeline McGee is the DNR's Great Lakes and Mississippi River Monitoring Program Coordinator. Aaron Giese was with us, Principal Investigator with the Wetland Monitoring Program. Aaron, you're designing a poster to show the connection between the monitoring program and specific wetland protection efforts. And this will be showcased at the Great Lakes Areas of Concern conference this month. What do you hope to convey?
Yeah, I'm really excited. That conference is going to be in Green Bay next week. And my poster will feature the strategy and methods that we have developed in collaboration with the DNR for assessing fish and wildlife habitats and populations. Those are beneficial use impairments in the Area of Concern program. And we worked collaboratively with DNR from about 2014 to 2018 to develop a method for assessing those two beneficial use impairments. And so I'll be featuring that, and then also explaining how the Great Lakes Coastal Wetland Monitoring Program is connected and using our methods to inform these beneficial use impairments assessments on that poster. So it'll be really neat to showcase how the Coastal Wetland Monitoring Program connects with the Area of Concern using those indicator metrics I described a few minutes ago.
I've seen pictures of people in waders. What is the data collection mission like in the summer months?
What do you mean by mission?
Well, I mean, you've seen people like getting out of boats and walking through wetlands with rakes. And really, I would imagine trying to get as close to the data, as close to wetlands as possible. What is that like in the summer months as you dispatch these researchers?
Oh, sure. Yeah, it's a fun time. Field biologists live for the summer, right? That's when that's the time that we shine, right? So we'll have crews that start out early in March, April, depending on when spring decides to arrive. And we'll have students and other researchers conducting inurine surveys. And then the bird surveys start in late May through mid-July. And that's around when the inurines wrap up. And then we have other crews that are conducting surveys. They're surveying wetland vegetation, aquatic invertebrates, fish, and water quality. And those folks will go out later in the summer to conduct those sampling methods. And then some of the crews even bleed into fall and winter. For example, for the invertebrate crew, they have to spend some time keying out and identifying the invertebrates that they've sampled. So it's a long stretch of time, and it's a lot of fun.
Madeline, turning to water quality, in 2020, the Lower Menominee River was the first waterway in Wisconsin delisted as an area of concern. How was that achieved?
Great question. So what we do in our areas of concern, I touched on it a little bit, is we have a series of beneficial use impairments. Based on the beneficial use impairments for that particular area of concern, we will assess the condition of them and figure out what lift needs to be made to return those degraded conditions to something that's more on par with the rest of the Great Lakes. We'll do that through what we call management actions. These can be things like dredging contaminated sediment and removing it from the system. They can be habitat restoration projects. They can be invasive species management projects. Once we've finished those management actions, completed them, what we do is we go back in after the fact and we assess the kind of updated conditions. This can be on different timelines based on the particular beneficial use impairment and what management actions were taken. Once our data shows that the conditions are kind of meeting criteria that we have set out to remove the beneficial use impairment, we can remove each beneficial use impairment kind of one by one as the data dictates. Once all of our beneficial use impairments are removed, we then put together what's called a delisting package, which essentially summarizes all of the work that's been done and all of the updated data showing the condition of the AOC currently. That package is reviewed by technical experts, not only here at DNR, but also at EPA, at federal agencies. We put that application package out to the public for public comment. And then there's a delisting process that is completed based on that application package. It goes through EPA, through the State Department, and Canada actually has to kind of be in agreement that the area of concern can be delisted.
That is Madeline McGee in the Office of Great Waters at the Wisconsin DNR. We have Aaron Giese with us with the Great Lakes Coastal Wetland Monitoring Program as we talk about Great Lakes Area Wetlands research and how this research is used. You can join in with your questions at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Aaron, in May, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that the federal government can no longer regulate the discharge of wastewater into wetlands unless they have a continuous surface connection to large bodies of water. What are the repercussions with this ruling for protecting wetlands within the Great Lakes Basin?
Yeah, that's a great question. Thanks for asking. And it goes back to your original question about talking about the importance of Great Lakes coastal wetlands that Madeline referenced. You know, this ruling is serious. We're wetlands, you know, I think of them kind of like sponges where they capture excess nutrients that come from runoff of non-point sources upstream, and they really soak in all of those nutrients like nitrogen and phosphorus and some heavy metals and keep that from being transported then into the Great Lakes. So they really help make sure that our Great Lakes water quality is of high caliber. And so, you know, this is really not a good thing at all when you're thinking about drinking water or recreating in the water. And then, of course, as a biologist, I couldn't possibly talk about this without talking about the biota, right? We have all of these important fish and wildlife that are using these places, and the more polluted places are, you know, those animals and plants are going to have a hard time thriving. So it is not good news.
Aaron and Madeline, thank you for joining us and sharing this research.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Aaron Giese, Principal Investigator for Great Lakes Coastal Wetland Monitoring Program, Senior Researcher with the Cofrin Center for Biodiversity at UW Green Bay. Madeline McGee is Great Lakes and Mississippi River Monitoring Program Coordinator for the Office of Great Waters at the Wisconsin DNR. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.